I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And also with me, Ian Morris.
Not just any Morris, Ian Morris.
Exactly.
It's also brought to you by you. Thank you ever so much to our patrons supporting us each week at patreon.com/UKtech. If you're a patron, then you're currently listening to your extended cut of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron, but would like to get our extended cut to my weekly columns, which this week included a behind-the-scenes look at how the show's made and the decisions we take when crafting the Patreon version versus the shorter free version, you get those every week, and you can get those by heading to patreon.com/UKtech, patreon.com/UKtech, and find out how you can support us from as little as a pound an episode. I think we hit a little bit of a speed bump in terms of onboarding new people as HR
Please
officers.
Please don't say that.
I will promise not to say it again.
Well, that's a boat.
No, indeed, but we are sailing through choppy waters in terms of significantly increasing our Patreon followers. It's a very healthy number, but if you have been thinking about getting on board this ship and helping us sail, then patreon.com/UKtech is how you can get involved. And there's no commitment. If you actually don't find that you get any value for your value, then you can just drop back and listen to the free feed. No commitment. But yeah. If you'd like to give us a try, please do. Thank you for all those who are doing. Now, Ian, let's get into the news tree and pick the juiciest information apple. We're going to start by talking about learner drivers who will have to follow directions from a sat nav and drive into a parking space in order to pass their test. That's from the 4th of December this year, according to BBC News this week. Drivers are also going to be expected to answer vehicle safety questions while on the move and complete 20 minutes of independent driving rather than the previous 10. Now, apparently this, according to at least the RAC Foundation, is going to be a far more realistic assessment of people's driving skills. But we did hear about this, I think, at least a year ago, possibly even slightly more. Back then, we didn't know when this would be implemented or if the GPS test, which obviously is the tech angle here for us, would be implemented. And at the time, a Guardian report said that the changes were going to form part of the biggest shakeup in the driving test scene since the introduction of the theory exam over 20 years ago in 1996. So, Ian, two things. I believe you drive.
I do.
I, however, do not. I learnt when I was about 18 and then never took my test. I moved to London and you don't need a car here, really, in the centre. Well, I certainly didn't. But well, I no, now you know. Don't live in London. So I'm going to start learning this spring. So I'm going to miss the GPS bit because I'll be learning before the 4th of December cutoff for this new thing.
But did you never take your test then? So you actually
no.
haven't? Oh, wow.
I never did. And I was quite a good driver from what I remember. It's just that it began to feel a little pointless to continue paying for the lessons.
True.
When I wasn't going to drive. So I didn't bother. But my point is that although I'm not going to take this GPS test, I'm so used to sort of helping, you know, people in a car just sort of point stuff out on GPS directions or use a GPS when I'm walking on a pavement that I think for a lot of people are going to have to take this test. It's really not going to be that big a deal. What do you think?
No, I don't think that. I think for most people, we're also used to, you know, fiddling with buttons and stuff in the car that, yeah, you're right. It won't be a big deal. I think it's an interesting idea. I like the fact that they're at least thinking about how to improve driving tests and make them actually relevant. I think that we'll see a lot more of this actually as we start to see self-driving cars appear. At the moment, obviously, for anyone who isn't aware, who is either out of the country or just hasn't ever been in a driving, you can have an automatic car license, which means you can only drive automatic cars. Now,
Those are ones that do not have gear sticks.
Yeah, exactly.
Or stick shifts.
And so, yeah, and as we move to electric cars, no cars have gears, so the driving tests will have to sort of evolve a bit. There'll probably be a lot more people who will just opt for the automatic because cars won't have gearboxes. And also, if you think about it, it may be that there might be extra things about electric cars that might add in extra tests, and then maybe there'll be an electric only test or something. I don't know why you'd do it, but you could do. That might have things about maybe driving a bit more economically, because you can get some power back from the regenerative braking, as well as being aware that the car is quieter and you might be more of a danger to other road users like cyclists and pedestrians. So I don't know. I think we might see a bigger jump in the change of driving tests from now on than we have up until now, because cars haven't changed a lot, but we're in a massive period of transition.
I think you're right. I think this spells that there will be major considerations made around how computerized cars, even if not self-driving or autonomous or even semi-autonomous, just the fact that cars have so much more computing power baked within them, that it's going to become necessary more and more to be tested on some of these things.
Yeah.
I think the other interesting thing is that right now, GPS navigation is by and large the same whether you buy it from TomTom or Garmin, or even just use your iPhone or your Android mounted to a dock. They're kind of manufacturer agnostic in that sense. Whereas a lot of the computerized systems that are coming into cars, you know, we're talking about things from Microsoft or Apple's alleged car system. Obviously, the ones that people at Intel and Qualcomm are working on, you know, they're all kind of designed to sort of lock you into an ecosystem. And so it'll be interesting if down the line, part of your test, you have to specify, are you taking an exam in an Apple-powered car or a Microsoft-powered car or an Intel co-designed car or something like that? And that's going to make driving tests a little bit more like buying a phone. You're actually having to decide what manufacturer you want to get in bed with or in a car with before you actually get qualified to do so. So that'll be interesting. But I think the other thing is that, and this came up in a conversation a few months ago I had with somebody who's asking whether I thought their children, when they're old enough to drive, would need to learn how to drive. And I said, well, there are going to be fallbacks, manual fallbacks in these cars for years. The steering wheel is not going to go away anytime soon. Not in probably the next 20 years will the steering wheel actually disappear. So you'll always need to be able to manually control a car in case the tech fails for some reason. In the same way, you have to know how to put oil in the engine. You can't just assume there'll be a person in a garage who can do it for you.
Well, I mean, I don't think there'll be engines, but, you know, also, there will always be a button to stop the car, won't there, at the very least. You'll always have that emergency cutoff. But I'm glad to see also that they are phasing out things that people never do, like reversing around a corner. You'll never reverse around a corner, not in the way that they teach you to reverse around a corner anyway. It just doesn't happen. So, again, I suppose it's kind of cool that they're actually paying attention to what's happening. Like, a lot of things in the world, especially government things, you sort of feel like they're very, very behind the times. And arguably, you could say this is behind the times because we've had sat-navs for, you know, 15, 20 years, haven't we? So perhaps it was well overdue. But even so, it's still encouraging to see them making a move towards the high-tech world.
It is. Now, I had a search around earlier, and I couldn't find anywhere else in the world, certainly not using Google, where GPS navigation formed a legal part of a driver's examination. So if you're in a country or area where this is already a thing, I would love you to let us know, podcast@natelangson.com, because at least my rudimentary Googling this morning suggested that we might be the first country to make this law. I find that hard to believe, but I couldn't find any evidence to the contrary. So please let us know if you know of one. podcast@natelangson.com. Ian, I'm curious, when you buy, you know, your sandwich or your, you know, your new underwear, you know, your chicken pieces, perhaps, to feed one of your cats. I'm curious whether you pull out your phone and its contactless payment system on it, or do you pull out your debit card and use contactless on that? Or do you just go all old school and use cash?
Here's the thing, Nate. I can answer this question with absolute precision. If the amount is under £30, I use my phone. And if the amount is more than £30, I use a card. Because obviously that's the contactless barrier, isn't it? It only goes up to £30. But I prefer to use my mobile. I find it a bit more convenient. You don't have to enter a PIN. I've really struggled with PINs, honestly. And I have a few cards for various different things, you know, business account, personal account, joint account.
All right, money bags. Well, let me get to the news.
Well, it's not
then.
About having a lot of money, is it? It's about having a lot of bank accounts. There can be zero in all of them.
Yeah, which would make the using of the cards rather pointless. Well, you're in a minority, Chief, and my answer to that same question would be the same as yours.
Yeah, I was going to say, what would you say? Yeah.
I would say what the last guy said, you. I use my phone. But according to a report in The Telegraph this week, the widespread popularity of contactless debit and credit cards is stunting the adoption of mobile payment services. That's at the Apple Pays and Android Pays of the world, at least in the UK. Now, this is according to the results of a study, which was based on polling of 2,000 people. So not an enormous sample, but not tiny either. Apparently, just 1% of British consumers would choose to use mobile payments in everyday scenarios, such as buying new pants or beef or whatever your daily...
Well, why do you think that is, though?
Well, apparently one of the reasons might be security concerns. People
well, that's
just...
bloody stupid, because I mean, using a phone to pay for something is more secure than using a card, arguably.
I would agree, but at the same time, that is one of the reasons cited as a concern. I think as well, the fact is that a lot of people might not actually know how to do it or know that they can.
Yeah.
It's not made super obvious, to be honest, because when you sign up to using Apple Pay, it's not really made clear in the same British terms that we see on our debit cards and in shops that it's just regular contactless. You look for a logo that says Apple Pay in shop windows, and I'm sure this is true in all countries where Apple Pay is accepted. The fact is, it's still just regular contactless like we've had for the last 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose in some ways one has to point out that we were a little bit ahead of the US.
Well it's funny that, because I was listening to Tom Merritt on Daily Tech News Show a couple of weeks ago was talking about, you know, how the US is they've managed to move into PIN territory, but they're not, sorry, chip territory, but still not using PIN, which sort of negates the point of using chip.
So they are inserting their cards in card readers and paying for things, but not having to enter a PIN to do it.
I believe that's right, yeah.
That
and a lot of
bonkers,
places still swipe. Whenever I go to the States, I'm still amazed at just how much swiping is done. It's not chip and pin. But
well, it's a lot of infrastructure to replace, isn't it? That's the thing. And and I noticed that there has been an uptick in the amount of... you do see it a lot. When I was at CES, I noticed that a lot of them have got now those Verifone terminals that we have in this country. So whereas before they had some, you know, completely different system, didn't they, with a massive signature pad and stuff like that. It's just crazy. But they also had the advantage, I suppose, that they didn't have contactless. And so therefore moving to Apple Pay was like a huge thing in the same way that contactless here was.
But that's interesting, because that was also one of the points raised on Tom's episode, is that in the same way that many African countries sort of leapfrogged wired broadband and went straight to 4G, perhaps the US and other countries are doing similar. They sort of skip chip and pin and move straight into contactless and fingerprint and biometric authentication, which lots of retailers over there are very advanced with. So it's interesting that in Britain, where I see people paying with their phones constantly, all day, and on the, you know, on buses, I mean, buses don't even accept cash anymore, so it's either contactless or nothing. And the majority of people that I see daily seem to be using their phones. I mean, I have occasionally see someone using their Apple Watch, and it always seems to fail. Well, let us know if you are in one of the 1% or in the 99% who aren't using these systems. We'd love to know what's holding you back and whether you are just about to venture into the world of contactless phone-based payments, and if so, what's been holding you back? Let us know, please. podcast@nateslangson.com. If you're on Vodafone, then a little bit of good news rained on you this week, in that they're scrapping roaming charges for UK customers in 40 countries, many of which are in the EU, but many of which aren't, such as Norway and Turkey and Iceland. Yeah. Now, this is only going to be applied to new or upgraded contracts, i.e. you've signed a new agreement with Vodafone. But it's fair to expect that eventually this will roll out at least to, you know, premium price tiers, although that's my own expectation. That's not confirmed. Now, this is ahead of the EU abolishing all roaming charges for all 28 or currently 28 member states in June. We talked about that, I think, last week or the week before. And so this is seen as something of a a bit of a bonus for Vodafone's customers, but it's not unprecedented. Three, I think, has been probably the leader in getting rid of roaming charges for free, and it offers free roaming in 42 countries, and that includes the US, which currently Vodafone does not. But it's another way that we can see British mobile customers not being affected by Brexit in terms of the roaming, the free roaming agreement potentially going away with our membership to the EU, because the networks are independently just setting up these agreements themselves. So it's a nice move. I'm on Vodafone, and so this is good news for me. And Ian, you're not on Vodafone, are you?
No, I'm not. No, I'm on Three.
You're on Three.
For my sins.
So you get two additional countries, which I believe is includes the US.
Yeah, and much slower 4G.
Well, that's...
And no 4G when you roam, either.
That's... Well, Vodafone does, because I looked at this. Yeah. On the countries that have 4G infrastructure, then...
Like the US.
Well, the US isn't included in the Vodafone one, but 4G is included for these lists. I mean, there's some interesting countries in here. I mean, there's the obvious ones you'd expect, like France and Germany and Hungary, Iceland is in there too. They're all 4G. Isle of Man's 4G, Latvia's 4G, Lithuania, Luxembourg. You can probably tell I'm reading down the list here. All 4G. Romania, San Marino, Slovakia, Slovenia, loads of places. There are some that aren't. Malta is not 4G. Gibraltar is not 4G. French
Ow.
West Indies is not 4G. Bosnia is inclusive but is not 4G. So there are exceptions, and I've indeed read the entire list of the exclusions from 4G. But good news if you're on Vodafone, I believe. Well, a story that cropped up a little bit of time ago, and we discussed this on a previous episode, is that Virgin Media is going to switch on home routers as a way of boosting their public Wi-Fi network. This is something I saw on Engadget, amongst other places this week, but it's the Engadget report I'm referring to here. And they're starting to roll out what was actually promised, or first teased at least, in 2015. So this is going to be compatible with anyone who's got a Superhub 3 router, which includes me, although I've not had a letter about this yet. I believe includes Ian, and he has had a letter about
it. I have had a letter, yes.
And customers are being alerted via email and post, where they can choose to opt out, or if they choose to do nothing, they'll be connected automatically. Now, before we get to the contents of the letter, which I'm hoping Ian will be able to read a bit of, it's just to explain what this means. Essentially, if you're walking around a neighborhood and you're a Virgin Media customer and you're looking for some Wi-Fi, you will suddenly find a lot more Virgin Media Wi-Fi hotspots available to you. And these are being provided by a separate Wi-Fi signal being broadcast by people's routers in their homes. It's not going to affect the people, as in their connection speed or their security. It's a separate allocation of bandwidth. It's a separate Wi-Fi signal. And Virgin Media, I believe, has promised that security is top concern, blah, blah, blah. Unlike, say, BT Phone, I don't think this is currently open to non-Virgin customers. I think this is a Virgin perk.
Yeah.
Whereas BT, you can pay to access public Wi-Fi, even if you're not a BT customer. That's as I understand it. And it is rolling out now. So if you haven't had a letter like I haven't, then you can expect one in due course. Ian, why don't you take us through what's in this letter? How's it being pitched?
Well, it's like a lot of... I mean, Virgin's sort of lucky. I even bothered opening it because most of the things they send me are incitements to get a new phone. And I'm just not interested. So it just lays out the fact that it won't affect your... So I'll read the bit about the your home Wi-Fi. So it says here, to add it to your network, we'll switch on a separate connection to the hub in your home. This means that the broadband you love and pay for will stay exclusively yours and remain just as secure. Don't want your hub to join our Wi-Fi network? No problem. To opt out, simply let us know by registering or signing into your account and clicking on your profile. It sounds pretty much like the whole thing is a completely separate connection. I have tried to find it on, you know, the Wi-Fi connection on mine. I don't think there's anyone else in my area that has. I haven't seen a Wi-Fi hub pop up in my list of Wi-Fi networks on my phone. So I don't think they've turned it on yet, because as my understanding of it is, when it's turned on, you'll see a Virgin Media Wi-Fi hotspot appear when you search for Wi-Fi in your area. And of course, the good thing about it is it includes the cloud, which is which is quite useful, right?
Oh, so, can you explain that?
Well, it says on the website, which they give you in the letter, which is virginmedia.com/virginmediawifi, just rolls straight off the tongue, it says that, you know, it includes the cloud as part of it. So
if you opt in, you get access to the cloud hotspots as well.
That's certainly what it implies. But I'll be very clear about the Virgin Media website. It is one of the most confusing places you'll ever go. Trying to work out one thing and another about this site is absolutely abysmal. But yeah, it certainly seems to suggest that that's what you'll get. And I guess it's easier for them to provide through a third party rather than doing it all themselves. And I noticed that in the letter they mention specifically things like Cafe Nero and Pizza Express, and those are again listed on the website, and they are Wi-Fi powered by the cloud, which is funny because it's a Sky company, so it's very odd. I'm trying to get the app on my phone, but it's not working. So
we'll have a look. I mean, certainly I've seen the cloud logo presented as a bonus for this. I've looked at the website now as well, so I think that is it. But we'll double check and we'll follow up on this. But if you've received a letter, if you're choosing to opt in, we'd love you to let us know why and whether you have any concerns. And if you're choosing to opt out, similarly, we'd be very keen to hear about why your decision was such. podcast@natelangson.com for all your Virgin Media Wi-Fi thoughts and feelings. One last story here then, Ian. Just a quick one, because I thought this was great, and I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. Planet Earth 2, the first one was groundbreaking, isn't it? But certainly the very highly regarded natural history documentary series from the BBC, is getting a 4K Blu-ray release. Now, we sort of expected this, but now we actually know that it is there, and apparently it is very good. According to the Engadget headline, it will make you want a new television. Now, I've been an owner of a 4K television for about a year, and rather, this just makes me want to own something to take advantage of the damn set. We had a couple of pieces of response to this news when I tweeted it on @textmessagepod, your source for all midweek text message content. Adam Brown said it won't, as in make him want to buy a new TV. It'll make me want availability to stream it in lossless 4K, not buy a physical media player for several hundred quid. Fair point. I think a lot of people would agree with that for sure. And I think the lossless aspect is key there, because Netflix does support 4K, but you get close enough and you can see the compression artifacts. What Adam is talking about here is wanting one that is as good quality streamed, which is very difficult to deliver for most people, at least. The bit rate on 4K must be 30-40 megabits for a Blu-ray.
Well, to have actual literal lossless would be quite difficult.
Not lossless. He means pretty much the same as Blu-ray. You know, I'm not sure what the compression rate is, because I'm sure it varies from picture to picture.
They're variable.
But it's bloody high, and a hell of a lot higher than Netflix. We also had Neil Boothman, who replied as well. He said, 4K really brings physical media back into play, as streaming just cannot match anything like the quality, but it's also damn expensive. So slightly different opinions on the same
thing
topic
is, though,
from Adam and Neil.
Doesn't need to be expensive, does it? Like, that 4K thing is just a way of making some money while the format's new. It's not going to last, and you'll be able to get it in 2 years' time for 30 quid or something. Yeah, it's a cynical. Again, I'm feeling cynical, and yeah. I'm seeing cynicism in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's which came first, the apple or the seed? That's the vegetarians, chicken and egg, by the way. Yes, well, anyway, let us know if you're going to be buying Planet Earth 2 on Blu-ray. I haven't actually, I don't recall seeing a release date. Do you happen to know when this is going to be released?
No.
Okay, well.
But it might not have a release date.
Yes. No, I think that's part of the problem. Well, we'll double check that and tweet out when we find out when it is. Let's move into a couple of emails. Our conversation last week about the differences between fibre optic and coaxial and copper-delivered broadband did provoke a number of tweets and a couple of very interesting emails, which I'm going to get through, one from Britain and one from the United States. I'm going to start here with one from Tom, who got this in literally minutes before we started recording the show. He says, "Hi, Nate. Was just listening to your piece on the nuances of broadband marketing. I tend to agree that BT in particular overuse the term fibre broadband. Our rural village was upgraded to fibre to the cabinet a few years back. The investment was really appreciated and connection speeds increased from around 800 kilobits per second to around 14 megabits per second now. We're about a mile from the cabinet, so we get nowhere near the up to 52 megabits we subscribe to. I appreciate that their general customer base probably doesn't need to get involved in the fine detail of cabinet location, but I do feel that there is more appropriate marketing term for what we get, local fibre broadband, for example. But don't get me started on the messy structure of the BBC website. Keep up the good work." That's from Tom, which is interesting and certainly something that we've heard not only with fibre to the cabinet, but also just good old days of up to 24 megabits per second when ADSL was all the rage. And people who lived 2 or 3 miles from their exchange would get, you know, very poor speeds compared to those who lived next door to the exchange, like Ian and I did.
Yeah.
And then we had this interesting email come in from Evan in the US, and he says he's a field technician for Comcast Xfinity, the broadband company we were talking about last week in the States. And he says that they bill their internet delivery system as HFC, which is called Hybrid Fiber Coax, which instantly makes me think such a technical term would never be adopted in Britain. But I'm glad somewhere in the world uses a sensible term. He says, "We are continuously upgrading the delivery network to fiber, but at the neighborhood and house level, everything is coax." So that's very similar to Virgin Media here. Evan goes on. He says, "As opposed to our old analog signal or the copper pair of phone line, our speeds are able to be guaranteed. For example, in nearly all of my areas, customers pay up to 200 megabits per second for a plan, which is guaranteed. Some limited areas can go up to 2 gig. Most of the time, I see an additional 10% buffer, so customers can have 220 to 230 megabits per second. Now, that's interesting as well, because that's exactly what we have, I think, with Virgin here too.
Yeah.
Do you experience that?
Yeah. And then exactly that. They will always give you a little bit extra data to mean that you will always get exactly what you pay for. And it's a really good customer service thing, because it means that you look at it and you go, well, you know, I'm getting more than I actually pay for. So it kind of feels like, even if it is sometimes a little bit slower, you're still overall winning. And, you know, I've got no real concerns with Virgin when it comes to the speed when it's working.
Yeah.
It flies. And it doesn't have the problems that BT has with distance. And you'll never see that.
Yeah. Well, Evan had said as well that pressure from Google Fiber and the marketing cachet of fiber to the premises meant that they did start building out some newer systems, but have recently started pulling back because of the increased costs and limited advantages, which I'm assuming is that for most customers who get ridiculously high speeds that fiber to the home actually provides, they're not currently actually able to take advantage of it all, but are paying for the privilege of being able to.
Well yeah, I mean, he does go on, and what I did like is quite good, because actually it's very difficult to fix fiber, which is what he says. So what you do is you end up with a price, you know, sending an engineer out becomes extremely expensive because it takes a long time to troubleshoot whatever, or you've got to replace a run of cable. Coax isn't quite as sensitive as that, and RG6, which he talks about, is the same stuff that Virgin uses here. So
RG6, for those not familiar, is a type of cable.
Yeah, a type of coax specifically, but it's very rigid. It doesn't bend very easily, so it's not well suited to being used, you know, say with a laptop in your house, which is, but it does offer a lot of bandwidth, and for a fixed installation where you're coming up to a router, it's actually fine. But yeah, you know, like, and I think that kind of cable actually is sort of perfect. And as I said last week, I don't care if it's delivered by fiber to my door or if it's delivered by coax. All I care about is that I'm getting the speed that, you know, good speed.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Evan, very much for the detailed email from across the pond. It's really interesting.
Good couple of emails there, actually.
Yeah, it's really interesting, I think, to see the similarities between what we have in our Virgin media world and how that compares to Comcast in the US. And thanks to Tom as well for the local take. You can have your take, local or international, read by, thought about, and discussed by Ian and myself by sending your emails to podcast@natelangson.com. We do love getting them, and so please do keep them coming in, or tweet us @textmessagepod on Twitter. And I should say, we do get a lot more people interacting with us on Twitter now, and I think part of the reason is we do throughout the week have a very steady stream of all the stories we might talk about at the weekend, almost all of which are very relevant to the listener of Text Message, if you like our predominantly UK focused take on the tech world. Do follow us there @textmessagepod.
Unless I'm in charge of it, and then I just go crazy, don't I? But anyway.
A little bit, but it's an endearing level of crazy, ladies and gentlemen. Endearing. Let's check in for a global take on this week's tech news with Tom Merritt. Tom.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we discussed just how personal we want those personal assistants to get, how intelligent we want those super intelligences to get, help you stop your smart speakers from being set off by commercials, Burger King, discuss why Amazon succeeds by not having all the information, and get Lloyd Case's lowdown on the new AMD Ryzen chips. All that and more, much more, at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Tom. Well, Ian, that's it. I feel pleased. I hope you do too.
I do. I absolutely do. Satisfied and pleased.
Marvellous. That's exactly the way to spend an Easter. For those of you who maybe were thinking of supporting us at patreon.com/UKTech, but haven't yet, we'd love to give you a little reminder that we'd very much welcome it. You get access to our extended version of the show, my weekly columns, and a variety of other things. That's patreon.com/UKTech. There are links if you go to our Twitter page, if you go to the blog at techpodcast.uk. You can find all the links to find it there. And maybe just give us a try for a few weeks and see what you think. There's no commitment, but obviously every penny goes to supporting the show and helps keep us doing the best we possibly can every week for you. And if not, the other great way to support the show is leave us reviews in iTunes and in other podcast places, or tell a friend or a spouse or a colleague or a son and daughter or a grandparent. Indeed, all are welcome. And that's the best way of supporting the show without any money. So thank you to everybody who is supporting us in whatever form you can afford. And I think on that note, Ian, we will say sayonara, and we will see you in just under a week, actually, since we're recording this week one day late thanks to Easter. Toodle pipsky.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.